Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Susie Gelman, and I'm privileged to serve as the board chair of Israel Policy Forum. If you're joining Israel Policy Forum for the first time today, I want to welcome you. And if you are a returning viewer, I want to welcome you back. As we reflect on the impact of the past 4 years on our vision of a Jewish, democratic, and secure Israel, and as we look ahead to what the next 4 years may bring, we are seeking to frame our work within a set of policy recommendations for the Biden administration and members of Congress. This package of proposals aims to achieve a realistic reset in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, strengthening the U.S.-Israel relationship and Israeli security, rebuilding U.S.-Palestinian ties, expanding Israel's regional integration, and preserving a political horizon for a two-state solution. The Realistic Reset Project will define the work of Israel Policy Forum in the months ahead, with special podcasts, articles, and other digital resources, and will inform our work on Capitol Hill. We're excited to present some of our recommendations to you in today's webinar. Before we begin, let me say to all of our supporters on today's call, thank you. Your generosity has been critical in bringing us to this point. For those who have not yet done so, I encourage you to make a contribution to Israel Policy Forum. Last year, Israel Policy Forum was able to reach tens of thousands of policymakers, community leaders, journalists, and interested individuals like you. Because of donor support, our realistic reset will provide a path forward to realize the vision of a Jewish, democratic, and secure Israel. Please help support this vital resource and visit israelpolicyforum.org/giving and make your gift today. Thank you. Now, on to today's program. To help us understand what a realistic reset of U.S. foreign policy could look like, we're pleased to be joined by three esteemed experts. Michael Koplow is Israel Policy Forum's policy director and the author of the weekly Koplow Column. Dr. Shira Efron is a policy advisor here at Israel Policy Forum and a special advisor on Israel at the RAND Corporation. Ibrahim Dalalsha is the director of the Horizon Center for Political Studies and Media Outreach, a private think tank in Ramallah, and served for 2 decades as a senior political advisor to the U.S. Consulate General in Jerusalem. With that, Michael, Shira, and Ibrahim, thank you so much for joining us. So, Michael, I'm going to start with you. Could you please lay out the core tenets of the realistic reset?
Sure. Thanks, Susie. So, as you mentioned, we have four elements to this realistic reset, and they are first strengthening the U.S.-Israel relationship and safeguarding Israel security. This is something that we feel is very important, certainly on its own right, as an American Jewish organization that is dedicated to Israel security and as one that is dedicated to a strong U.S.-Israel relationship. Obviously, we want to see the strong partnership between the United States and Israel continue. Second, we have restoring the relationship between the United States and the Palestinians. This is something that during the Trump administration obviously suffered in a number of ways. I'm sure we'll talk about it later in this conversation. But the Trump administration did a lot to downgrade our relationship with the Palestinians, not only in terms of things like cutoff of aid, which most people know about, but also in terms of things like making it harder for us to engage with the Palestinians diplomatically. And ultimately, that doesn't really benefit, certainly doesn't benefit the Palestinians, but it also doesn't benefit Israeli security policy, and it does end up putting a lot of stress on the U.S.-Israel relationship. Third is expanding Israel's normalization throughout the region. This is obviously an element of policy that is most associated with the Abraham Accords, something that we hope continues and expands, and we want to come up with ways for those accords to be sustainable, since in a lot of ways, there are concerns about whether they will be sustained in the future, given some of the U.S. policy concessions that were required to get them. And we also want to make sure that while Israel normalizes its relations with its neighbors and is widely accepted throughout the region, that there is a way to have that process also contribute to progress on the Israeli-Palestinian front, which ultimately is at the core of Israel really getting to a spot where it can have normal relations with everybody, with everyone. And lastly, we have the one that really undergirds all this and stands as a foundation, and that is preserving a two-state outcome. And this is something that, of course, is our core mission, but it really flows from the fact that we don't believe that negotiations at this point are realistic or are going to happen or have a chance of success, even if they were to happen. And so it's really critical to do things to make sure that a two-state outcome is still possible down the road when you have a better political environment for negotiations. And that involves a whole range of issues as well. But preserving two states, even though it's its own separate pillar here, is really the thing that is the foundation for the rest of it.
Thank you, Michael. So as a follow-up, could you explain the current need for a reset of American foreign policy as it relates to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And why would you describe the proposals we're discussing as a realistic reset? Didn't the Trump administration also call its plans realistic?
The Trump administration did, in fact, call its plans realistic. But there were a number of elements of Trump administration policy that I think were not realistic. And some of what we are proposing is trying to address that. But some of what we're proposing is also a commentary on previous U.S. policies that themselves have not been successful and that perhaps did not have a realistic chance of success. So for starters, as I mentioned, U.S. policy now for decades has been about getting the two sides to the negotiating table. That is simply not a realistic policy in the current environment. I'm sure everybody on this webinar is well aware of the general politics on the Israeli side that at the moment make a successful negotiation with the Palestinians difficult. I'm sure everybody on this webinar is aware of the politics on the Palestinian side that make a successful negotiating process difficult. It's also the case that the Biden administration is very clearly telegraphing that they don't intend to go down that road. They've said it explicitly. Secretary of State Blinken has said it explicitly. The fact that the State Department is not creating a special envoy office is yet another indication that they are not looking to try to get the two parties together. And so when that is the case, it's important to come up with a set of proposals that doesn't rely on just trying to get to talks, but that also doesn't rely on letting the situation really just deteriorate without any U.S. involvement. So I think that's one component of this. Another component of it is that we saw the Trump administration try a number of new things. One was to basically bring all the pressure that they could to bear on the Palestinians to get them to reengage. And that was not successful as a strategy. All it did was push the Palestinians further away. And while the Trump administration did have successes in its own right, such as the Abraham Accords, that was not a success in the realm of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the Trump administration's efforts to get the Palestinians back to the table to engage with the Trump plan completely failed. And those were policies that were constantly described as realistic and turned out to not be so. Another thing I'll point out is that the Trump plan itself was very oftentimes, as you note, described by the administration as the most realistic plan out there. But it had a number of deep flaws that were unique to it because they weren't things that had been proposed by anybody before. Things like unilateral West Bank annexation, 30% annexation up front on day one. Things like an expectation that every Israeli who is anywhere in the West Bank now will be there until the end of time, no matter what. Those things were, they may be things that had support, certainly in certain quarters in Israel and that were supported by the Israeli government. But just as policies on the other side that may be supported at times by other parties, that doesn't necessarily make them realistic solutions or realistic paths forward. And so what we're trying to do here is an ambitious plan, but it is one that takes into account the current politics and the current realities on the ground and doesn't try to advance things that really have little chance of actually advancing or being accepted by the two sides.
Shira, let me turn to you. We have to ask these days, where does the two-state solution fit into a plan we are calling realistic? Shira, you co-authored a study for Israel Policy Forum last year and one for the RAND Corporation that was published just last week that looked at several models for resolving the conflict. Please tell us about your research and how the two-state framework stacks up against these other options.
Hi, Susie. Hi, all. Thank you for having me. Well, I don't know how long I have for this, but I'll try to be a little bit brief talking about this issue. So in our Israel Policy Forum study, which those of you who heard my co-author, Evan Gottesman, and myself talk about it, we examined the two-state solution and how it compares against alternative outcomes. I wouldn't call many of them solutions because some of them include like non-democratic Jewish state, continuation of the status quo, but alternatives. Including also positive ones, confederation, one democratic state for all. We also looked at the Trump Peace to Prosperity plan at the time. And we compared how they would perform against a predetermined set of criteria. We engaged in expert consultations and trying to rank how they would perform. And some of the criteria were like endemic to, you know, IPF's mission, how to keep Israel Jewish, which of these alternatives would keep Israel democratic. But some were very standard, ease of implementation, the cost, acceptability to the international community. And I think it's no surprise that we found that the two-state solution to be very flawed, but overall, it fared better than all other options. That doesn't mean that it could be easily achieved, and this is where we go into the realistic. However, we didn't find that whereas the two-state solution is hard to achieve, any of the other options are more attainable. Now, in the RAND study, we took it's very complementary to the IPF study because we took a people-based approach. We didn't go speak with the experts, but we actually conducted dozens and dozens of focus groups with hundreds of Israelis and Palestinians all over Israel, the West Bank and Gaza. Obviously, I couldn't go into Gaza, but we had a subcontractor do it there. Those discussions were a 4-hour long. So sitting in rooms with 7-8 Israelis and Palestinians at the time, speaking for 4 hours about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and what future they see. I must tell you, it was a pretty sobering experience because the news is not good. There was a lot of despair on both sides. And I guess I would sum up, and we can go into the details in a moment, but I would sum up the bottom line as the Palestinians didn't think that there was any solution. The Israelis, for the most part, didn't think there was a problem. We found that for most Israeli Jews, the preferred path forward was continuation of the status quo. When they walked into the room, they didn't like the status quo, but when we presented the alternatives, all of them, they said, well, you know what, the status quo isn't that bad. It's not worth the risk. The impediments for moving in any other direction was mistrust in the Palestinians, the notion of there's no partner on the other side. I guess it was the second one was also that none of the other alternatives seemed feasible. So the status quo is attainable because it's the status quo. It's the reality today. Nonetheless, the two-state solution came in as a close second. So I think that's important. The Palestinians in our discussion were unsatisfied with all the alternatives, including the two-state solution, because they didn't believe they would actually have a state, a sovereign state. One that is theirs to own with the dignity and free of Israeli occupation, free of soldiers, settlers. But of course, they were unwilling to entertain continuation of the status quo, which for them is really unbearable. So a modified state, two-state solution was their preferred option. So I think even though the study didn't offer any much constructive way forward, it did show us that the least objectionable path to the average Israelis and Palestinians representing all walks of life is the two-state solution. And this is where I think the realistic reset is so important, because, yeah, we know the political conditions are not right. But clearly, yeah, maybe if there was a change in leadership, people will follow. But still, the trust between the two sides is at rock bottom. No one is prepared for it. And the risk of another failed process would shatter any trust and belief in a political solution ever. So it's important to stay away from it. However, it's really important to keep the door open, the window open for a two-state solution, creating the conditions that could make a two-state solution one day viable when political circumstances change, but also addressing the key impediments to progress on both sides, which is what Michael spoke about at first. First is Israeli security. No matter Israel's strength, Israelis are afraid. There's a real endemic fear to being Israeli, and there's fear of the other side. So strengthening Israel's security is an important one. And the second one is also treating the Palestinians as independent people with dignity, respect, giving them a political horizon. And I think these were all laid out in the reset.
Thank you, Shira. Michael, back to you, and then Ibrahim, I'm turning to you next. So Michael, in today's context, strengthening U.S.-Israel security ties isn't merely a bilateral affair. It also means working with Jordan, Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority. What role will each of these actors have to play in the next 4 years?
I think that when people think about Israeli security and they think about things like security assistance, they tend to think of the $3.8 billion annually that the U.S. provides Israel in security assistance. But it isn't simply about what we help out Israel with, because everything is interconnected when it comes to security. And while the $3.8 billion that we provide Israel annually is critical and is something that we want to make sure is protected and remains above politics, the same goes for the $75 million that was appropriated in the last fiscal year for the Palestinian Authority security forces. Because without that money that is used to train and equip the PA security forces, security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel would be far more difficult. And the fact is that a more professionalized Palestinian Authority security force, and they certainly are far more professional and better trained than they were a decade ago, is really important for the security of Israelis as well. It's not just a function of the actual coordination against threats in the West Bank, for instance. The PA every year returns literally hundreds of Israelis who have wandered into Area A, returns them safely to Israel. And this is another way in which having an active and trained and equipped Palestinian Authority security force directly impacts Israeli security. So, you know, it's important to make sure that that coordination continues and that the PA security forces remain professional. And we have a large role to play in that in the U.S. And, you know, you mentioned Jordan and Egypt. Jordan and Egypt both play large roles in different places to keep things quiet and stable. The Egyptians are far and away the most important outside actor when it comes to Gaza. We've seen the Egyptians act as mediators between Palestinian factions in Gaza. We've seen the Egyptians act as a go-between between Israel and Hamas. So, you know, that relationship is important as well. And making sure that we coordinate security moves with Egypt is critical. And I'd say all the more so for Jordan, which is not only one of, along with Egypt, two countries to have signed peace treaties with Israel. Jordan is also one of the most reliable American partners in the Middle East. Jordanian stability is very much tied up with what happens in the West Bank, and the Jordanians themselves play a large role that's formalized in the Israel-Jordan peace treaty in what takes place in East Jerusalem and on the Temple Mount. And so thinking about Israeli security, as I said, isn't just a function of our relationship with Israel. It's thinking about our relationship with these other regional actors, both in terms of their partnership with the United States, but also the way that they all are interlocked together in terms of Israeli security too.
Ibrahim, thank you for your patience. So I'm turning to you with this question. The Palestinians were acutely impacted by the Trump administration's policies. What should the Biden administration do to rebuild U.S.-Palestinian ties? And how can the Palestinian Authority play a productive role in this effort?
Thank you, Susie. Before I answer that question, if I just may, I want to thank both Shira and Michael for, and especially Shira for expressing what I think should always be borne in mind. And that has to do with the fact that, you know, this conflict, no matter how long and no matter how intractable, without the sharing of land by the creation, the concept and notion of two-state solution, I think we will all be lost in the mazes of the history and conflict down the line. And one other point I would actually like to add here is that at present time, if attainability or you know, trying to get into a two-state solution quickly doesn't work, I think what is missing from public discourse, both in Israel and here on the Palestinian side, is the fact that no one is thinking about an integrated approach, a gradual approach that would take us out of total stagnation into a process like that. So I just meant to actually mention those two points quickly. And back to your question, I think, first of all, I think that the Biden administration, the fact that the Biden administration has won and the Trump administration has done, has by itself, you know, sent a very positive signal to the Palestinian Authority, and mainly because the, you know, the so-called deal of the century, the ultimate deal, U.S. vision for, you know, peace and all of that, which was completely dismissed by the Palestinians, have basically been taken off the table automatically by the election of the Biden administration. The issues that the Palestinian Authority would want to see the Biden administration doing, and hopefully this is on the agenda, and I know, and everyone knows now, it's no secret that there are contacts at certain levels between the administration and the Palestinian Authority, which is basically, you know, undoing the damage that was caused by the Trump administration. And that's not only about aid and, you know, obviously, you know, the question of PLO office and status of the PLO as a whole as a terrorist organization, which has been a partner to the U.S. and Israel for actually more than three decades now, or around three decades now, needs to be fixed one way or the other. Reopening the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which is de facto or was de facto political representation to the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, all these issues on the bilateral side between the Palestinian Authority and the U.S., I think, are on the agenda. The question is how quickly, how far, and how firm both sides will be in order to solve them. From the Palestinian side, obviously, you know, there are many issues that need to be tackled. And one of them is, you know, the question of prisoners and martyrs payments, pay to slay, known as, you know, more generally by, I think, Israelis and Americans. And regardless of the different arguments, on the Palestinian side, there is a different argument. But I think in terms of why these payments are made, but regardless of that, I think, you know, there is a track where this could be addressed. It's a difficult issue for the Palestinian Authority. And here I just need to explain one thing. The Palestinian perspective on it. First of all, you know, whatever I'm going to say is not basically about saying that this is not going to be solved. I'm just saying, you know, it's difficult because it's one of the issues that the Palestinian Authority believes firmly that, you know, statistically there is no evidence whatsoever that those people who are paid or, you know, or compensated after they actually, whether they are inside Israeli prisons or after they are released, that they actually go back and carry out violence. The question of containment and the issue of containment, if you will, is basically what motivated this from the start. Now, you know, people will argue about this. And again, you know, this is not what I'm saying is actually not about, you know, saying that it will not be resolved. But I think that the PA is working on this, and what would accelerate a solution to this thorny issue is, I think, a dialogue between the two sides, and not only between the Palestinians and the Americans, by the way, because I know that the American law, for example, applies only when it comes to, you know, American Israelis or dual American Israeli citizens. It doesn't actually go, you know, to Israelis as such. Whereas when it comes to Israel, it is a question about Israelis, regardless of whether or not they have U.S. or any other nationality. So, you know, a dialogue needs to actually come in order to find ways where, for example, I'm just throwing this as an example, I think there is readiness on the Palestinian side to actually do away with the future payments rather than past payments and move on, you know, in a context where you actually get rid of this issue once and for all. So, you know, that I think what the PA is trying to do and presenting this to both the U.S. administration and Israelis.
Thank you. Michael, Ibrahim just talked about pay for slay. As you know, that's long been an issue raised by Israeli and American officials alike, who viewed this system as rewarding increasingly severe acts of terrorism. How do you think the Palestinian Authority should approach this issue, and what are the potential ramifications if it does not address it?
There's no question that PA prisoner and martyr payments are a big issue, not only for the United States, but for Israel. You know, the United States Congress has spoken about this very clearly with the passage of the Taylor Force Act and with the passage of the Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act. I should note with enormous bipartisan majority. So this is not a fringe issue, certainly in the U.S. This is one where everybody is concerned. And on the Israeli side, there's similar Knesset legislation, which actually does not go as far as Taylor Force, but that requires Israel to deduct from the tax revenues that it collects on the PA's behalf and then transfers to the PA. So, this is definitely a huge point of contention. Now, even leaving aside the fact that it's a point of contention, it's not a great policy. Obviously, it creates a perverse set of incentives, and so I think there's little question from my perspective that it has to get fixed. I think that the way to fix it, and this is what the PA has been discussing, is to create a social security system, effectively. That is not simply for prisoners or families of prisoners. It's for everyone, and you have payments throughout Palestinian society that are based on need, as opposed to based on the length of a prison sentence. And the Palestinian Authority has been discussing this for a while. I know that they have been discussing this. They've been talking about it since before the election. I know they've been discussing it with Biden administration officials, and hopefully it'll get done. It's something that is sensitive, and I think this is a point that often gets lost here in the U.S. It's not such an easy thing that you just snap your fingers and do. The role of prisoners in Palestinian society is very large, and it's a politically difficult move to make. That doesn't obviate the need to do it, but it is important to point out that it is politically controversial on the Palestinian side. If it doesn't get addressed, then from a perspective, it's very difficult to see how the PLO mission gets reopened in Washington, for instance, because that is directly subject to legislation that ties it to these payments. And similarly, if it doesn't get addressed, it's going to place real restrictions on the U.S.'s own spending in the West Bank and Gaza, because Taylor Force does not allow spending at the moment because of the payments that directly benefits the Palestinian Authority. And how you define what direct benefit means is a question for government lawyers, not for me. But certainly, it is going to restrict ways in which the U.S. spends money, including on humanitarian assistance, right? Just to be clear, we're not only talking about direct budgetary support for the Palestinian Authority. The U.S. hasn't provided that since 2014, since well before Taylor Force. The U.S. ended that out of concern over the prisoner and martyr payments and over concern about Palestinian governance. So we're not even talking about, that returning. What we're talking about is even the U.S.'s ability to really fund infrastructure projects or humanitarian projects in the West Bank. So it's really important to get addressed. The Biden administration, I think, is probably going to prioritize it relatively heavily once they turn to the Israeli-Palestinian sphere, and hopefully it gets fixed.
Shira, I'm going to turn back to you, but I also want to let our audience know that in the chat, you will find links to both of the studies that were referenced earlier in our conversation. Shira, one of the most notable developments to come out of the last year was the succession of normalization agreements between Israel and various Arab states. What does expanding Israel's regional integration look like under the Biden administration, and how can this process be instrumentalized to keep prospects for a two-state outcome alive?
So, I mean, we don't know what the policy will be, but as a candidate, Joe Biden obviously has endorsed the normalization agreements known as the Abraham Accords. And I think that the administration would continue to pursue normalization with other countries. This has been a longstanding bipartisan U.S. policy for as long as we can remember. And there's no reason why not to. This is really a positive development. I think there's real opportunity here, but the challenge would be to link the Palestinian, progress on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process to these normalizations. Now, not conditioning normalization on advancing Israeli-Palestinian peace, because we've seen this has been counterproductive, and frankly, this should not be the condition, but maybe marrying the two approaches. The talk is about Saudi Arabia. On both sides, Israel and Saudi, there's eagerness to formalize ties. However, for Saudi, as a leader of the Muslim world, there's really a lot of sensitivity, and they've often cited the lack of progress on the Israeli-Palestinian front as an impediment to formalizing ties. If Israel was willing, and I think this would call for U.S. leadership saying, okay, we will support, encourage normalization between Saudi and Israel, but then it could be a Saudi insistence on, well, this should also come with renewed Israeli commitment to a two-state solution, maybe an Israeli commitment to stopping settlement activity. Think about it, with the UAE, the annexation threat, which was a very credible threat. We could almost forget, but it wasn't that long ago, was off the table. So this connection could be made. I think it's also important that while we can't expect every issue to be solved now, and this is what my friend Ibrahim spoke about, maybe normalization can help achieve interim agreements, going back to more of a roadmap approach. This whole all or nothing approach has led to nothing, but maybe normalization could lead to interim agreements. And finally, there's also the economic dimension, and I don't want to limit it to, we can have the Arab world invest more in state building, the Palestinian state building. It's an important objective, but we can go broader. We did an analysis at RAND, it's not published yet, but I can talk a little bit about the numbers. But only the normalization between the four countries and Israel can create 150,000 jobs, not in Israel, outside of Israel, in the region. And if normalization would grow to the 10 numbers that we were speculating about a few months ago, we could talk about 4 million jobs and more than $1 trillion in new economic activities. So there could be an opportunity here for the Palestinians. And this is not economic peace. This is not beautifying the occupation. This should be seen as part of state building, capacity building. And I think that without an orchestrated U.S. policy, none of these things could happen. But there's a real opportunity here.
Ibrahim, back to you. As you remember, the Palestinian Authority was vocal in its opposition to the normalization agreements between Israel and other Arab states, particularly the first one struck with the UAE. Given that the Biden administration has said it would continue supporting Israel-Arab state normalization, how can the Palestinians ensure this is done in a way that will be beneficial to them?
I'm not an official spokesperson for the PA, but I can tell you basically the following in an assertive way. The main concern that the Palestinians had, and by the way, they have reset their relations and their position against normalization a few months ago. The main concern that they had was basically that this would be a headway or a leeway to implement unilaterally and with Arab countries' cooperation or consent, the Trump plan or the Kushner plan, which would have been a de facto sort of like one state outcome that puts Palestinians in some sort of reservations without an independent entity, and that was dismissed outright. The main concern was that regional countries, including Palestinians, are basically turning, including the Emiratis, the Saudis even, with backing the process in an indirect but in a very visible way. We're basically backing away from supporting the Palestinian demand or the Palestinian position, which had embraced the Arab Peace Initiative at the time, which called for normalization with Israel only after or as a result of reaching an end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That was the main concern. And, you know, with the Trump administration, even before the Trump administration actually was voted out in the U.S., there were steps that were taken by the Palestinians, basically returning ambassadors to Bahrain and the Emirates. They never recalled the ambassador, for example, to Sudan or even to Morocco, which came forth in terms of those agreements. So the Palestinian position has basically absorbed, if you will, it was a real crisis and a shock to the Palestinian sort of like political position and leadership. And they, you know, tried to oppose it. And then they realized that they can't actually do that. But with the boarding out of the Trump administration, I think that the way has been paved for Palestinians to come and say, okay, fine, normalization. We were never against normalization. The question was whether before or after you solved the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And now, you know, since this is becoming part of, you know, like a trend in the region, many countries are joining, the question is, don't do this at the expense of Israeli-Palestinian conflict for the sake of Israelis and Palestinians who actually live here together. And eventually, if this conflict is not resolved, continue to have eruptions of violence or could actually continue to be in a deadlock. So in many ways, the Palestinian position on this issue is not going to be a problem in terms of, you know, restoring relations with the U.S. administration. And I actually say again, also in terms of, restarting a sort of political process with the Israeli government, because I think from my experience and having worked actually for the U.S. government in the past, you know, my advice to the Palestinian leadership has always been, and I was always channeling that kind of advice and continue to, is that this should not come at the expense of direct communications, contacts, and a political process with the Israeli government, because that is what makes and breaks, you know, between Palestinians and Israelis, with all due respect to the very influential and very important role of the U.S. administration. And I've seen that throughout the, the past decade. The question is, I think, in direct response and short response to your question, is that this is not going to be a major or a problem even in terms of restoring, a political process with the normalization deals going on.
Thank you. I'm going to get to audience questions in a minute, but I want to ask each of you a different aspect about the Trump plan. So, Michael, what does it mean to walk back the Trump plan, which also endorsed annexation and a de facto one-state outcome? And Ibrahim, I'm going to turn to you about how did the Trump plan impact the Palestinian public's attitude toward the viability of a peaceful two-state solution, peaceful two-state resolution to the conflict? Can the impact of the plan be mitigated in this regard? And finally, Shira, can Israelis' expectations about American concessions be reset or managed, given all of the political freebies that the Trump administration handed out to the Israeli right and the rather lopsided nature of the Trump plan? So, Michael, starting with you about walking back the Trump plan.
I think it's as simple as making it clear that the Trump plan is not currently the basis of U.S. policy or the U.S. view of a reasonable way to resolve the conflict. Ultimately, whatever Israelis and Palestinians agree to, that's how the conflict will be resolved. And I think that if Israelis and Palestinians were inclined to agree on the Trump plan, then from my perspective, they're fine. It's not the U.S.'s job to impose the solution on the parties. But the fact is that the Trump plan is something that the Palestinians are simply never going to accept by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, the annexation element is not anything that was realistic in any way, shape, or form. The notion of Israeli enclaves scattered, you know, extraterritorial enclaves scattered deep inside a Palestinian state or Palestinian enclaves inside Israel. And again, not Palestinians themselves or Israelis themselves, but extraterritorial enclaves, was not something that was ever realistic. And referring to a Palestinian capital in Jerusalem when it's three non-contiguous neighborhoods, one of which isn't in Jerusalem at all, and two of which are in the Jerusalem municipality, but on the other side of the security barrier, is also not, you know, acceptable to any Palestinian leadership. And so, you know, that in itself is what makes, you know, there are other things as well, but those in particular, I think, made the Trump plan a non-starter from the beginning. And so I think it's just as simple as getting back to a space where we're actually trying to, once we think talks are actually going to be successful, which, you know, again, I'll stress is not now, but whenever the U.S. determines that that is, it means supporting something that's actually in the zone of possible agreement, as opposed to something that's going to be imposed on one side, you know, with sort of bludgeoning them on over the head to try to accept it.
Ibrahim, the question about how the Trump plan impacted the Palestinian public's attitudes towards the viability of a peaceful two-state resolution of the conflict, and whether you think the impact of the plan could be mitigated.
The public attitude towards that specific plan basically was total rejection. In fact, in some public opinion polls, there was like reflection of about 95%, 96% after the plan was released. And I think, frankly, the opposition to it, that's a margin of error. I think it's more than 100%, to be honest with you. And I think Michael has just alluded to some of the points in that plan. But essentially, what I think was... there are so many details in the plan that are rejected by the Palestinians. Don't get me wrong. Palestinian people, not only Palestinian leadership. So it's not a diplomatic position. The question of lack of you know, there was no attention whatsoever to a very key question in the Palestinian sort of like mindset. And that has to do with Palestinian integrity, Palestinian dignity, Palestinian independence, and Palestinian national character embodied in a sovereign state. Now, we will differ on the details of that state, but with the meanings of sovereignty from a, you know, strategic sort of like political or security perspective, whether it's a militarized, demilitarized state, all of those aspects. But the core of it has to be the preservation of Palestinian national character and independent character from the state of Israel, while turning into a key partner to Israel in all spheres, you know, economic, political, and others. That's what the Palestinian people would actually accept. The problem is, in the Trump plan, is that there was like a total negation. Palestinians will be like in those complexes, and 30% of West Bank will go away, and Jerusalem has nothing to do with the Palestinians. And, you know, it's like in Kufr Aqab, as like Michael was pointing out, that is not a starter for even a dialogue with the Palestinians, let alone the game. Now, in terms of what is the attitude today to that plan, I think that people saw, you know, the public statements coming from the new administration, and the fact that the Trump administration was voted out is basically... you know, that this means the plan is off the table. And, you know, this was confirmed one way or the other by the U.S., the new administration's announcements and policy statements on this issue. And, you know, if this plan comes back to be, you know, placed on the table, I think that the Palestinians, their leadership, the Palestinian people and their leadership will never sort of like deal with that plan as a realistic or as a possible even terms of reference for discussion or for negotiations. So, you know, like, I think that everyone needs to take that into account. And if we start a new approach, it needs to be on terms of reference that we might differ on, Palestinians and Israelis, but terms of reference as a starter do not actually necessarily mean the end game will need to be literally there. It's the beginning of the process. And the Trump plan, from a Palestinian perspective, is a non-starter, Frank.
Thank you. Shira, if you could briefly reflect on Israeli expectations about American concessions, can they be reset or managed given the experience of the last 4 years with the Trump administration?
Yeah, you know, there's no question the Trump administration gave Israel everything, and let's say even more than Israel wanted, right? There's, of course, recognizing Israel, Jerusalem is Israel's capital and having an embassy there, recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. But there were also more controversial measures, stopping aid to the Palestinians, even aid assistance to UNRWA, which was it's a controversial organization. I see a question in the chat about it, and we can talk about it, but it's not something that the Israeli officials, and I've even heard the prime minister himself try to advocate against it. It it's not something that Israel wanted. On the key things, we already heard the president administration is very clear. They're not going to roll back. You know, the embassy in Jerusalem is not going anywhere, nor should it go anywhere. There's no point even discussing sovereignty of the Golan Heights at the moment. So in a sense, the sweeteners, the freebies are going to stay there. But we've heard this as the administration tries to set its to reset bilateral ties with the Palestinians, there will also likely want a new to revive the U.S. consulate in East Jerusalem, where Ibrahim worked for over two decades. Restoring aid, if Israel sees those things as zero-sum game, as measures taken against them, that would be very unfortunate. There's no question it's going to be a very different approach, unless I missed something on the 45 minutes we've been on this call. President Biden still has not called Netanyahu. This is something that keeps the Israelis very busy after a White House where Netanyahu was basically felt like the house guest. There's no ambassador yet here after having a very powerful ambassador in Jerusalem. And Israel, whether it wants to or not, would have to get used to not being, the key ally of the United States and the top issue. This is out of scope for our discussion, but I don't anticipate, the Israeli-Palestinian issue to be where we could see some friction. It's probably going to be on Iran earlier on.
So we have a lot of audience questions, so I'm going to ask you to just briefly address them. Starting with a question from Shloimi Perel. Water conservation and equitable water distribution is crucial for Israel, Jordan, the West Bank, Gaza, and the Golan. What do each of you think about the work of EcoPeace in this regard? Can mutual water and environmental interests be a locus for peace reconciliation in the region? Ibrahim, do you want to start with that?
I think, I don't want to go specific into issues, but the answer is definitely yes. And the irony of this whole conflict is that we share resources, Palestinians and Israelis. The question is how to actually agree on sharing them rather than fight on it. Palestinian water resources, Israel's consumption of water, reservoirs in the West Bank, across regional cooperation, all of these things are basically subject to future coordination and cooperation between a Palestinian, emerging Palestinian state and Israel. What I meant to actually say, and not to downplay the those elements, economic elements, but I think that, or environmental elements and regional cooperation, I think that the Palestinian state, what is missing from the also public discourse, both in Israel and in the Palestinian side, is basically, the creation of a Palestinian state is about more cooperation between the two peoples at that level in all domains, because essentially we live in the same home. The resources there and the prospects of actually, holding very tight Israeli-Palestinian cooperation and extending to the region is something that I think will be at the heart of any process that would come. Bypassing the Palestinians, however, and trying to do that with the Arab countries without solving the Palestinian problem will simply, keep this conflict in place. And whether the Palestinians can impact or not the Arab countries' position, that doesn't really matter, but they can impact Israeli and Palestinian lives here because, we're here to stay. There is no other way of, of doing this. Abandoning or sidelining it is not going to solve the problem.
Anybody else want to add anything before I go to the next question? Okay.
EcoPeace is a great organization and they're doing great things. It's one of those areas, water, where we can have an interim agreement, right? This is where we say the all or nothing. You can solve the water issue between the sides and demonstrate goodwill on an issue that's not as controversial as Jerusalem, refugees, and other stuff. So I would endorse it. The problem is that pragmatism is not prevalent here.
We have a question from Tracy Wilkinson of the Los Angeles Times. Tracy asks, Michael said that the Biden administration was sending a clear signal that it's not going down that road, i.e. becoming a major arbiter of the conflict. Is part of that signal behind Biden's decision not to telephone Netanyahu in the first couple of weeks? And what message is that decision sending? And I just have to say, my impression is that this is, you alluded to it, Shira, this is the issue that is obsessing every single Israeli who is perceiving with every passing minute the increasing slight or worse. But Michael,
it's clearly causing a lot of angst. I'll just note that I don't know if it was, it's either as this webinar has been going on or maybe a little before, but I think Jen Psaki announced today that either Jen Psaki or Ned Price announced today that when President Biden starts calling Middle East regional leaders, Prime Minister Netanyahu will be the first one he calls. So I think that it's mainly a function of where President Biden's priorities are at the moment, more than it is a comment on Prime Minister Netanyahu himself. You know, President Biden has made very clear that when it comes to foreign policy, aside from everything he's prioritizing domestically, that when it comes to foreign policies, prioritizing China and supporting NATO allies, and if you look at who he has called so far, that you know that backs that up. You know, there have been multiple conversations so far between Tony Blinken and Gabi Ashkenazi, between Lloyd Austin and Benny Gantz, between Jake Sullivan and Meir Ben-Shabbat. So I don't think that Israel has been neglected. But you know, the fact that there hasn't been a call yet between Biden and Bibi, I'm not all that worried about it. But yes, it is reflecting the fact that unlike President Trump, who spoke about the ultimate deal on the campaign trail, and you know, unlike previous presidents who really prioritized this issue, this is just not the issue that's being prioritized.
Shira, do you want to add anything from an Israeli perspective on this?
Childish. I very much agree with Michael. You hear the speculation that they're not calling because it's snubbing Netanyahu, or that a call would help Netanyahu in the election. You know, Israel's running up to them again. So at this point, calling would be intervening in the elections in favor of Netanyahu, and this is the modest contribution that this administration did. I think it's nonsense. And I would even dare say it's a bit tone deaf on the part of Israelis, because you know the U.S. is facing one of you're all there now facing one of its biggest crises in history, right? Global health crisis, economic crisis, trying to restore alliance, trying to restore its leadership role in the world, political struggles, partisans. I mean, challenges to democracy. So this whole like me, why are you not calling me? I just don't think it's smart policy. I don't know why putting this at the center serves Israel's interest. But hopefully, as Michael said, this will be put to bed after the call this week.
So we have a question from one of our Atid leaders, Zach Schenk. The UAE has consistently said that after normalizing relations with Israel, they will be able to better advocate for the Palestinians with Israel. How might this advocacy play out economically and politically? How do the UAE's reported funding cuts to UNRWA impact the UAE's ability to do this? Ibrahim, do you want to take that first?
Frankly, the issue of the Emirates' relations with the Palestinians is a difficult topic for me to address right now, because there are issues that relate to even before the Abraham Accords with the normalization deal. What I want to comment on is actually the fact that the issue of UNRWA and trying to basically kill UNRWA, the way that the Trump administration dealt with it was in my opinion, a mistake. Yes, UNRWA needs to be reformed in interim period. That's a question that, or an issue that everyone agrees on, but basically it needs to gradually be dismantled. I don't want to sound like avoiding basically answering any of the Emirates-Palestinian relations, but because I really think that the problem between the two sides did not really start with the normalization deals. And that's, I think, a false impression out there. You know, there has been a boycott between the two sides since at least 2011 because of domestic Palestinian issues and what the Palestinian leadership sees as interference by the Emirates, into Palestinian politics. So anything that Emirates does or doesn't do is not really related to their agreements with Israel. It was a provocation from a Palestinian standpoint that the Emirates did this with Israel because they were the first ones to overthrow the Arab Peace Initiative. That's true. But it's again, while they fixed their relations with Bahrain and they actually never reacted to Sudan and Morocco, they still have issues with Emirates. So I wanted to highlight this position. And yes, when it comes to, all other issues, the Emirati position, I think, in line with the Arab position, need to be intact with what would be advised by the Palestinian leadership, but also by the U.S. and by other key players. I think there was a lot of, not going to say capitulation, but basically there was a lot of undue cooperation by some of the Arab countries with the Trump administration in the past 4 years that caused both, in my opinion, Palestinians and Israelis more damage than actually good, including the question of UNRWA. Because if you overkill UNRWA or if you basically overreact to the question of how you dismantle UNRWA and move it to host governments prematurely, you're likely basically to cause this to become an explosion rather than, a positive thing. And this was not done carefully or smartly by the Trump administration during those past 4 years. And unfortunately, some of those countries were actually playing along for their own reasons, for their own interests with the U.S. administration. And I suffice with that. But if I may, Susie, there was like one question that I saw actually in the chat box. People are asking two things. One is whether the Palestinians will ever give up, Jerusalem and the Temple Mount as such. And my answer to those people is simply no, they will never give up the question of East Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. For Jews is a Temple Mount, for Palestinians and Muslims it's a mosque. And the irony of this whole thing is that it will continue to be a mosque, in my opinion, before and after solving this conflict, and it will continue to be a holy site for the Jewish people. This will never change. The question is how we agree on respecting the de facto situation and status on there without changing it, which will be part of that solution. And, for the Jewish people to continue to hold to that place emotionally and religiously the way it is. And, that, I think, answers the question on whether or not Palestinians will ever give up. It's a question, the other way around, whether the Jewish people will ever give up Jerusalem. Of course not. So, the question is not about that. And the other thing about refugees and refugees from Lebanon and Syria and Jordan coming back, I just want to allude to people that, they're has been many initiatives in the past and proposals, including the Clinton proposal, which was accepted by the Palestinians. And I think to some extent was accepted by the Israeli government during the past negotiations, but there was no ample time in order to and there were other complications around the issue of final status, not the question of refugees itself. I think that there is a much more realistic approach to how you solve this return of refugees to the state of Palestine that would emerge and having three or four other criteria to resolving this. That would be also controlled by an Israeli government. It's not going to be just about 5 million or 6 million people coming back to Israel. So I just wanted to answer those two questions in the chat box. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you. We are at the top of the hour. I didn't know, Michael or Shira, if you have any brief last final thoughts before I close. No? Okay. Well, we had way more questions than we had time for, as we always do. So thank you to our audience for your good questions, and please keep them coming every week. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have today. Thank you, Michael, Shira, Ibrahim, for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Once again, I'd like to thank our supporters who are with us on today's call. Your generosity makes programs like this one possible. Again, if you have not yet done so, please consider making a contribution today at israelpolicyforum.org/giving. Thank you all for joining us today. Once more, I encourage you to subscribe to our podcast, Israel Policy Pod, sign up to receive the weekly Kaplan column in your email inbox, and visit our website to access recordings of our previous briefings. Please stay tuned for an announcement regarding our next video briefing, which will take place next Tuesday, February 23rd at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, Remember, if it's Tuesday, it's an IPF webinar. Thank you, everyone. Toda, shukran. Thank you.